It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we recap the National Curling Club Championships held this weekend in Wausau. Now, lawmakers in Wisconsin are proposing an update to the state's Farmland Preservation Program to give more farmers an incentive to participate. The program offers tax credits to farmers to keep their land for farming use as opposed to selling it off for commercial, industrial, or other development. The goal is to maintain more land in Wisconsin for farming and agriculture while also meeting sustainability standards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer, we'd love to hear from you about your experiences with land preservation and conservation. If you are watching in your community, are you seeing a lot of former farmland turned into something else? What do you think about that? Do you want to see efforts to keep farmland? Farmland. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Oldenburg is a Republican State Assembly representative from the 96th District in Western Wisconsin. He's co-author of the bill to update the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program, which his own farm in Viroqua has participated in. Representative Oldenburg, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you today.
Now, this program has been around in its current state for a while now. Can you give us the basics on how it works?
Well, I started this program on my farm in 2009. Actually, I had to write a 590 nutrient plan, which a 590 nutrient plan is the same thing as these big farmers, big CAFOs and everything have to follow. And then also goes on and you have to implement it. You know, you got to do soil testing, soil sampling, and that will, then you got to put a SNAP plus two program. And then it shows how much soil you're actually losing. And also with a soil test, what kind of nutrients do you have to put back into soil to get your projected yield, what you want to do in that. So we don't over-fertilize and we save soil. And that's kind of the idea behind farmland preservation. It's as far as taking soil samples, you can hire it done, can do it yourself, send it in, and then you actually can implement it within yourself through the SNAP Plus 2 program. It's a computer program that UW Extension created for this. And it's a little time consuming, but other than that, I think the benefit is huge. Everyone should be soil sampling your crops anyway, or your land, so we don't over fertilize and get the maximum yield out without spending too much money.
So you're speaking of one of the two goals, as I understand it, Representative Oldenburg, that, you know, preserving soil quality, and this is going to have impacts on water quality as well. Also, if I get it right, this program, the goal is to keep farmland as farmland. Can you talk about that part of the program?
Well, you know, that's the thing, you know, one part of this program, if your township is zoned and zone exclusive ag, you can get in this program without having any other neighborly farms in this program. So it's just on a yearly basis that way. Then if you do an enterprise and agricultural area, that where you have to have other farmers also with you and get a certain amount of acres to do that. That way, this program, this new bill that we put out last week or a couple of weeks ago, would reduce that timeline to 15 years to 10 years. That idea is get more farmers involved, because when we did a survey back in 2018, that was one of the things that farmers didn't want to sign up for 15 years, in case, you know, either they sold your land or something else has happened, they could not get out and stuff like that. So, well, the biggest idea of this is actually help the farmers, smaller farmers, big farmers, actually get some beneficial tax credit out of this. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why we are raising the tax credits on this, because of that was one of the issues that farmers got back to us, is that it wasn't worth their time to do that. So that's the beneficial of maybe put some more dollars in the farmers to actually be able to stay on the land longer, so they don't end up selling the land to a developer or some other entity.
Can you talk a little more about the changes in your new legislation that you're working on? You hit the key point there. I think that's upping the per acre tax credit for people who participate. Are you hoping that's going to be enough to, you know, overcome some of that hesitation you were just talking about from farmers?
I think it'll be a big step forward. I think especially going, if you're in an agricultural enterprising zone or entity, that was only $5 if you were not, your township wasn't zoned. That'll go up to $10. You know, that's huge. And you got to remember, you maybe have 100 acres of crop land. then you have maybe 100 acres of woods. So that's 200 acres. You get tax credit on the whole thing, just not the land that you actually farm in. So that is very beneficial to the landowner that, hey, I want to keep it small. I want to keep it, you know, at this size, because I do get that extra tax credit, and then where we can, you know, beneficial of the whole thing.
Talking to Representative Lauren Oldenburg from Western Wisconsin, Assembly Representative, looking at a program in Wisconsin aimed at conserving and preserving farmland. It's called the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program. He's working on legislation to expand it, hopefully bring more farmers, he says, on board with it. Representative Oldenburg, it sounds like one possibility is, you know, I know farmers are busy people, and they might look at this and say, well, it sounds like a lot of bureaucracy. Is this really worth my time?
I don't believe it is bureaucracy. I mean, it's, you get paid. I mean, you get tax credit when you go to file your taxes in February or March, whenever you have to do that. Right off the bottom line, you know, you get the sheet from your land conservation office, say you finished your program, your 590 nutrient program, and through the whole process, they sign off on it. You give that to your tax person. You can take that tax credit right off your tax, you know, taxes. So, and if you don't pay any taxes, you actually get a check from the state of Wisconsin. So, I mean, it is beneficial. It's a little bit of time, but everyone should be doing their new soil testing. That's probably your biggest time anyway. You get double benefit. You get a tax credit on that. And then you also know what nutrients is required to raise that crop. So I think it's just a little bit of time. I think it's a little bit of education to say, hey, this program is out there. And I think if anyone, any farmers listening to this, reach out to your land conservation offices, you're at the local county level, and say, hey, I'm interested, and see what you have to do.
I wanted to ask about the county conservation offices. As I understand it, they're the ones who say, you know, every now and then they go and check it out and say, yes, you've got this plan, this conservation plan in place. Are there enough of them? Is there enough county conservation officer to go around to implement this program?
Well, I've been very fortunate up here, and where I represent Crawford County, Vernon County, and part of Monroe County, have three great leads there and stuff. And there's also a bill that's going through that would fully fund those programs at 170 and 50 to get more dollars to the county level, so they actually could fund those land conservation offices. So I think it's vital, especially here in Western Wisconsin, to make sure the farmers are doing a good job on the land, preserving the soil, and make sure the water's clean. I think they are very helpful individuals and group of people that the farmers should be leaning on if possible.
As you talk to your fellow farmers, Representative Oldenburg, I mean, in general, this program aside, do you hear a lot of interest in preserving, you know, soil quality and local water quality?
Big time. I mean, this last year, I was the first time number one, time-wise, I don't have a lot of time, I put cover crops in, and I plan to continue to do that going forward. And I think that has taken off big time, cover crops. And you can implement this in the farmland preservation to get your soil loss down there where it needs to be, if you have some steep slopes where I live up here. And also, it's good nutrients for soil health. Cover crop has probably taken off in the last 5 to 10 years. Something that I think is just a start, and I think it will continue to be a practice that farmers will put in their rotation. I think there's going to be more and more creative ways of how to get that cover crop on in a timely fashion going forward. That's always a challenge up here, where, you know, we get an early winter, early fall, that we can't get these cover crops started. That's the biggest challenge up here, is getting cover crops on timely fashion.
And when farmers are coming up with their conservation plans, is there like a one size fits all, or is it going to look different in a place like, Viroqua area, where you've got that rolling country and more slopes versus, you know, flatter parts of the state or different crops or what have you?
Definitely. I mean, that's what you implement this program where it fits your rotations, the way where your land lays. Yes, cover crops, and you get further south, you can get those crops in sooner and quicker and get established. So I think, yes, everyone's farm will be different. I think cover crops have really come a long ways on dairy farmers that actually get their corn silage off in, you know, maybe end of September, mid-September, and they can get a cover crop established there. And I bet they're seeing big time advantages of that.
And Representative Oldenburg, as we wrap up, I understand you've got some bipartisan support here, some support from rural and urban districts in the state. What is your timeline? When are you hoping to get this thing done and voted on?
I hope to get this voted on. It's kind of a unique, it's an appropriation as dollars, so you always have to deal with joint finance. So I would love to get this done before the budget process or within the budget process. Get the bill passed and then get it funded through the budget. Hopefully it's done by the time the budget is done. That would be July 1st.
Representative Oldenburg, thanks again for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Representative Lauren Oldenburg, Republican serving Wisconsin's 96th district in the state assembly, a farmer in Viroqua, with us today to tell us more about his bill that would expand the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Project. Up next, two experts on farmland conservation and preservation practices join us to talk more about some of the challenges farmers might face to maintain their land, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the state put more emphasis on preserving farmland and on conservation efforts for soil and water quality in rural areas? Why is that important to you? How does it affect your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about farmland preservation and conservation here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your questions, maybe your own experiences as a farmer. What kind of things do you do to help maintain soil and water quality? What are ways that the state or federal governments, if any, could help you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Diane Meyerfield joins us now, Sustainable Agriculture Coordinator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension, also the Wisconsin State Coordinator of the USDA Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. Diane, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Allison Volk is the Land Protection Project's Deputy Director at American Farmland Trust. Before that, she oversaw the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program that we were just talking about as part of the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Allison, we were just talking about the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Program. You used to oversee that. What kind of things did you hear from Wisconsin farmers who participated?
I think we learned from farmers that the tax credit for participating in the program really wasn't enough to help incentivize continuing to be in the program. We also, heard that implementing practices like adopting nutrient management plans, it's expensive. And so having that tax credit available can really help support farmers as they adopt these practices that are so beneficial to water quality and the preservation of farmland.
And Diane, is this a common story you hear that farmers might want to up their sustainability game, but those initial expenses might be a little high?
Well, absolutely. I talk about a range of sustainable practices, and the question does always come up about what is the cost to farmers up front. And a lot of times with these sustainability things, there are higher costs up front. There may be economic benefits in the long term, but it's hard to ask a farmer to do something and carry those losses early, hoping that in 4 or 5 years it'll start paying back.
And Allison, do you think this idea we just heard from Representative Oldenburg of nudging up those per acre tax credits, is it something like that? You think something that'll push more farmers over the edge and say, yeah, I'll give this a try?
I think so. I think it certainly couldn't hurt to increase those levels and to keep them increasing with inflation.
Now, Diane, you work directly with farmers and people who train farmers. What are some of the most common sustainability practices that you see Wisconsin farmers taking up?
Well, Representative Oldenburg mentioned one of them, which is cover cropping. In the past 10 years, really, the interest in cover crops has really grown enormously, from something people didn't even really think about to a significant percentage of Wisconsin farmers doing it. But that's only one of a huge suite of conservation practices, starting with things like reducing tillage, and planting cover crops and putting in other conservation practices, to things like agroforestry, where you're integrating trees in your cropping system, maybe planting more windbreaks, or even planting rows of trees around in the middle of regular farm fields. That's called alley cropping. So there are literally dozens of conservation practices that farmers can do and are doing in Wisconsin.
Allison, we've been talking mostly about the sustainability part of the equation here. As I understand it, some of the work you do at the American Farmland Trust has to do with keeping farmers on the land and land in work in agriculture. What are some of the biggest challenges to doing that?
Affordability and access to land is a big concern. You know, we have a large population of farmers who are retiring. And in Wisconsin, there's three times as many producers over 65 as under 35 years old. And we really need to make sure that there's farmland available for those emerging producers to have access to.
We are talking about conserving and sustaining farmland here in Wisconsin. Allison Volk is with us from the American Farmland Trust, and Diane Meyerfield with UW-Madison Division of Extension. Diane, first day of spring today. What kind of things should be on farmers' minds as they start to think about, you know, keeping their farming as sustainable as possible?
Well, definitely nutrient management, making sure that any fertilizer and any manure applications are not more than the plants need to grow. And so that's number one. Farmers have been thinking a lot more about soil health in general and practices that can increase the amount of carbon in their soils. And so as we approach the planting season, it means also being very aware of the moisture levels of the soils before you run heavy equipment on them. Sometimes the weather just absolutely doesn't cooperate, but that's an important consideration too. And there's a whole range of practices that can benefit soil health. Not all of them in things that are front of mind in the spring, like keeping the soil covered all year round and having a more diverse crop rotation are some examples.
Allison, I understand one tool you work with at the Farmland Trust is conservation easements. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. Conservation easements are deed restrictions that farmers voluntarily will put on their land to ensure that the land remains permanently available for agricultural use. And they remove the development rights and reimburse the farmer for those development rights. Oftentimes, the farmer is then able to reinvest that funding in their operation, and the money can stay in the community. And, you know, if you know, and it ties into kind of what Diane is talking about, because if you know that land is going to remain in agricultural use and available for agricultural use, the more apt a farmer is to invest in the health of that land by then implementing those conservation practices.
We heard from Debbie in Franklin, who couldn't stay on the line. She says her municipality is one of the few in Milwaukee County that still has farmland, and her community really wants to see more farmland preservation efforts, like the program we were talking about, the Wisconsin Preservation Program. Allison, I want to ask you about that in particular. In a place where, you know, a piece of land might look a lot more lucrative and valuable being developed for something other than farmland, is that an area you focus on, keeping at least some of that kind of that land in agriculture as cities start to encroach on it?
It depends. You know, the conservation easement has to be used in tandem with other land use tools, such as planning and zoning, because the last thing we want to do is create an island of farming that's surrounded by a development where the farmer can't farm because there's no farming neighbors. So we really need to try to create a balance between farming and development, and then to make sure that we're not acting too late so that we're protecting farmland that's nearby other farmland.
Diane, for farmers who might like to participate in state or federal conservation programs and maybe don't know where to start, what kind of help is available for them in Wisconsin to get connected?
There's a lot of resources. Representative Oldenburg mentioned the county soil and water conservation programs. So starting with your county, Extension also has agricultural advisors in almost every county of the state. And then there are a range of federal programs that, among other things, can provide financial support for a whole host of conservation practices. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Service is in every county in the state, and they do both technical advice and, in some cases, financial assistance for conservation practices, ranging everything from improving manure storage to some of these, you know, really sort of innovative agroforestry practices and things like planting strips of prairie on the farm.
And Allison,
and then the program I work with, Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, is a national program, but that doesn't so much give technical assistance. But for the farmers who are really out there on the cutting edge, there's some good information, and there's also a grant program that SAIR runs that can help farmers try out new and innovative practices.
And we'll leave it there. Diane, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Diane Meyerfield is Sustainable Agriculture Coordinator for the UW-Madison Division of Extension, and Allison Volk is the Land Protection Project's Deputy Director at American Farmland Trust. Been talking about efforts to preserve Wisconsin farmland and to help farmers conserve soil and water quality. Earlier, we heard from State Assembly Representative Lauren Oldenburg, who's sponsoring legislation on the issue, specifically a Wisconsin project called the Wisconsin Farmland Preservation Project. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, join the weekly series on cooking. It's Food Tuesday, with a focus this week on cast iron cookware. You can join in with your questions, how to clean the darn things. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. I was off last week. I always look forward to vacations, sure, but then I get ready to go and I look at the conversations we have on the schedule here on Central Time and I think, wish I got to do that one. Well, last week was no exception. Among the conversations I missed, a great talk about movies that are so bad, they're good. You shared some of your favorites. Here are some more that you posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jimmy writes, I just love Z-Grade. And the most legendary of them all is the iconic Canadian campy classic, Werewolf Fever. Robert says, saw a really great good bad holiday movie this past Christmas season, Santa Games. It tried to capitalize on the very awesome holiday movie Elf, because Will Ferrell says no way to Elf 2. Features the actor who played the store manager in Elf. Bad acting, close to zero plot, but it sucked us in and led to a two-hour discussion after watching it. We plan on making it a holiday tradition. And James says, if you want so bad it's good cinema, check out the works of Neil Breen. I used to be into bad movies, mostly moved on. Watched a lot of mystery science theater back in the day, though. So bad, it's good. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a water quality specialist from the DNR talks about the challenges and opportunities for saving unique ecosystems in Mississippi River backwater areas here in Wisconsin. Now, 24 teams from around the country met in Wausau over the weekend for this year's National Curling Club Championships. While this game of strategy, stones, and brooms on a sheet of ice originated in Scotland back in the 1500s or so, curling has been part of central Wisconsin winters for over a century. The love of curling has been passed down for generations in Wausau. Our next guests say that love was on full display at this weekend's championship event. Kim Soussens is the president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Forrest is a member of its board of directors. Kim and Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. Kim, can you tell us a little bit about the field of competitors this year and how far they
came? Thank you for having us.
You bet.
I think we got a little delay there. So Kim, could you tell us a little bit about the field of competitors this year? I think, we'll bring this down for a second, see if we can connect in another way with our guests. Sounds like a pretty big delay. Hey, if you're a fan of curling yourself, we'd love to hear from you. Shoot us a note. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or call. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll try to sweep up this connection here a little bit and get that delay out of there. Love to hear from the curling fans out there. I know a lot of Central Wisconsin. A lot of Central Wisconsinites are curlers themselves. Well, let's take a moment and check out our Wisconsin Life this week, shall we? And then we'll see if we can get this cleared up. St. Patrick's Day was last Friday. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Irish culture.
Irish dance has been booming for quite some time in Milwaukee, where there are multiple dance schools. If you're not familiar with this art form, Irish dancers typically keep their arms straight at their sides while their legs quickly leap, kick, and shuffle across the floor. Usually, St. Patrick's Day is a huge day for dancers as they travel across the area performing for people. While the pandemic has impacted their events this year, dancers and instructors have found a way to keep hopping and stepping in a safe way. So, to celebrate that dedication to the Irish culture, we're revisiting this story from 2014. Back then, my sister and I attended an Irish dance competition, known as a fesh, in Oconomowoc. We were Irish dancers when we were much younger, so it was super fun to watch the talented dancers, see how the reels and jigs have evolved, and to hear the live music. Take a listen.
Oh, fesh? No one knows what a fesh is. A fesh is an Irish dance competition. It is craziness, but it's a competition where kids get to come and dance. We have 930 competitors. They come, they do two steps of a dance on stage. We have reels, we have jigs, we have slip jigs, hornpipes, treble jigs, sets. I'm Maura Kathleen Heck, and I'm an Irish dance teacher and owner of Cashel Dennehy School of Irish Dance in Milwaukee.
It's just really fun. You get to fly, which is awesome. And I don't know, it just takes everything else that you're stressed about away and you just get to focus on dance. My name's Siobhan McPhail. I'm 14. I dance with Kinsella Academy of Irish Dance and I live in Milwaukee. I think it's definitely a sport because you need to have stamina and strength and flexibility and anything that any other athlete needs.
I'm Mariana Papa George. I'm 13 years old and I dance for the Trinity Academy, Mequon, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee. I competed in the under 14 Open Championship category and I just finished my treble jig. This dress, it's baby blue. It's a lot of white. It has a lot of accents on it that's like a Celtic design. And it's kind of like a tennis skirt style. And then my mom added some blue crystals along the sketching of the skirt and then to the bodice.
The dresses many years ago used to be more authentic and they would actually had Irish designs on them from this book called The Book of Kells. They've evolved into more geometric shapes and bling, as everyone calls it. And the hair, I can't. There's folklore about, you know, oh, back in the days of ancient Ireland, like they all curled their hair and it, so it bounced nicely as they, you know, were dancing down the aisles and dancing at the crossroads. When I was younger, we actually had to put the little pink curlers in our hair and sleep on them overnight, and your head against a window if you're driving to a fesh in Ohio. Oh, it was so painful. And then it took, you know, an hour to uncurl them in the morning. Now they're wigs and they take 5 minutes.
I like to put the wig on the Americans. My name is Sean Beglin, and I am the owner and director of Beglin Academy of Irish Dance. Before I finished high school, I was with Riverdance part-time, which still is a big Irish dance show. I left high school and got a call 2 days later that Riverdance wanted me full-time, and my first city was Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Riverside Theatre. We're very lucky to be in Wisconsin. What is great about this city is that in Milwaukee we have Irish dance plus Irish music plus Irish singing plus Irish language. That we have Celtic studies. There is such a bloodline of Irish running through this area of America that you can't get away from it.
The Those were the voices of Irish dancers at a fesh in Oconomowoc back in 2014 in honor of St. Patrick's Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's Central Time. In just a few minutes, we'll look at another Wisconsin tradition, curling. First, it's the first day of spring, which means we've made it through another Wisconsin winter. We humans aren't the only species who need the right habitat during the winter months. Take bass and bluegill, for example, who like to winter in Mississippi River backwaters. They need the water to be around a certain temperature for a cozy winter season. Our next guest has been tracking these conditions and finding that climate change and other human influences on the river have created challenges for this specific ecosystem. Sean Giblin is a water quality specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources based in La Crosse. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Paint us a picture of this unique Mississippi River backwater ecosystem you're studying around, I think, Alma it is.
Yeah, so, you know, what we've been seeing lately, too, and, you know, and just sort of the basic biology of, you know, some of these backwater fishes on the Mississippi River, too, you know, they need water that's warm enough, especially the backwater fishes, but with adequate oxygen, too. So it's, you know, there's a very narrow band of conditions that they can tolerate, you know, kind of what we call sort of the Goldilocks zone, where we have, you know, water that's warm enough, but still with adequate oxygen. You know, it's really over the last couple of decades, too, you know, just the increasing discharge we're seeing on the Mississippi River, is making this habitat type increasingly scarce.
When I think of climate change and it's affecting an animal population, I think, oh, well, that means the water's warming up and that's bad for them for some reason. It's actually a little more complicated than that. Can you connect the dots between the impacts of climate change and what's happening, as you mentioned, that water flow through and how it's affecting the habitat?
Yeah. So, you know, in this case, you know, it's a little paradoxical, too, where it's, you know, really it's the volume of water that we're having trouble with, too. You know, if you look at the Winona gauge just north of La Crosse, I think from 1929 to 1980, you know, we never exceeded a mean annual discharge of 45,000 CFS, 1929 to 1980. You know, really since 1980, you know, we've exceeded that threshold 12 times, and seven of those have been since 2010. You know, and really that's a problem too, because, you know, a lot of these backwaters are connected to channel habitat. You know, in that channel habitat, you know, the water is quite cold in January. So, yeah, typical January water temperature in a channel is, you know, very close to 0 degrees Celsius too. So, you know, with these backwater fishes needing slightly warmer water, you know, 1 degree Celsius or higher, you know, we're just pumping too much of that cold channel water into these backwaters, you know, making the habitat unsuitable.
Now, in your study, I read that, you know, in normal natural circumstances, there might be ways that a habitat like this could recover itself. But the Mississippi River is not exactly a natural environment when it comes to water flow. We do a lot of management. Is that making it harder for this ecosystem, this backwater ecosystem, to recover?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, sort of a feature of, you know, kind of what we've done to the river, you know, the locks and dams, the navigation channel. You know, it's, you know, the river really, you know, doesn't have the capacity that it once had to, you know, to really rebuild these habitats. So, you know, really it's up to us to sort of assist kind of in building these habitats for fish and wildlife on the Mississippi River.
What would that look like?
You know, many times, you know, it's fairly simple, you know, in these type of scenarios. So for instance, one of these backwaters where we might have too much cold water, you know, moving into this backwater complex, you know, it'd be as simple as sort of, you know, shunting some of that flow, you know, into that backwater, you know, to get that right mix of, you know, we're metering in enough of that colder, high oxygen water, but not too much. So, you know, and, you know, in other cases, it could be things like, you know, enhancing the water depth too, but, you know, sometimes it's quite simple. It's just a matter of, you know, changing the level of connection between channels and backwater habitats.
What kind of species are we particularly worried about here?
You know, what we're talking about in this report, you know, is mostly the backwater fish. So these are a lot of the fish that people like to catch, you know, the bass, bluegill, you know, northern pike, yellow perch, crappie, you know, a lot of the sort of high value game fish, you know, which is, you know, people, you know, really like to go out to fish for those species in the wintertime.
Are we starting to see more difficult fishing already, or is this something you're worried about down the road?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's starting to, you know, our fisheries folks are sort of looking at some of these trends too, but it, you know, it's like you look at, you know, in general, sort of like, you know, in a number of these backwater complexes that we looked at, you know, in this recent report too, they've, you know, really been unsuitable, you know, particularly during, you know, that decade of 2010 to 2020, where it was just, you know, incredibly, you know, almost 90th percentile flows for that entire decade too. You know, you just look at those habitats that are unsuitable too. So, you know, we are starting to kind of look at sort of the long-term effects of this in terms of overall kind of biodiversity and, you know, these game fish populations on the Mississippi.
Talking to Sean Giblin from the Wisconsin DNR, looking at Mississippi River backwaters here in Wisconsin, important habitats, as you just heard, for some very popular fish here in the state. Threatened in part because of the indirect effects of climate change. Sean, when you're talking about higher levels of flow, is this, you know, a lot more rain, a lot more precipitation, or is it also what we're doing with development in the overall watershed?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of both, but, you know, I think the predominant driver is just more precipitation. You know, if we look at that 2010 to 2020 period, you know, a typical, you know, annual rainfall here in La Crosse, you know, slightly over 30 inches, you know, that decade, you know, the average was, you know, 40 inches plus, you know, so, you know, the big driver is just more precipitation throughout the year.
Is this something that, you know, I mean, I've spent time on backwaters in your neck of the woods. Can we see the difference from decade to decade?
In terms of
like just
trends?
Visually, would it look different to me if I visited 10 years ago versus now?
Yeah, you know, I think you'd be able to see, you know, just sort of visible velocity moving through these systems too. So it's, you know, we measure something called water residence time, which is the time in days that it takes to flush completely new water into it. So, I mean, in some ways you can see it visually, but in some ways you sort of have to, you know, kind of use, you know, the scientific techniques that we use to observe it.
On a practical level, if we want to do some of the remediation techniques you were talking about earlier, who does that? Who would be in charge of actually implementing things and paying for it?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a couple of restoration programs on the river. You know, there's the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program, you know, that does projects like this too. You know, there's a number of, you know, complexes, you know, that are actually featured in the report we just released. You know, they're in the queue for restoration efforts too. But, you know, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, is it just the sheer magnitude of these areas that are under stress. You know, it's, you know, we certainly need, you know, more resources than we are to, you know, to really keep pace with the degradation we're seeing too. So, you know, it's a matter of sort of there are programs in place, but, you know, it's just the funding levels that, you know, need to keep pace with the stressors, frankly.
Now, as I mentioned, it's the first day of spring. What are you watching for this time of year to see how these different fish species made it through the winter?
Yeah, so you know, this is about the time of year too, where you'll start to get some of these fish kill reports. You know, the ice comes off too, and to basically look at, you know, kind of, you know, the reports of, you know, various areas where the fish didn't make it through the winter will start to come in too. And, you know, what we did earlier this winter, you know, was sort of look at a number of these backwaters kind of early in the winter and then late in the winter, you know, to look at things like dissolved oxygen and, you know, and how conditions held up too. But, you know, this is typically, you know, the time of year we'll start to get reports of fish kills, you know, in areas that, you know, the fish succumb to those stressful conditions.
Is this something where you're looking for some citizen science? If people are out there fishing, if they see something, say something to you?
Yeah, you know, we always like to get reports in terms of what's going on too. You know, one thing about the, you know, the river rats on the Mississippi, you know, they tend to be a really observant crowd too. So, you know, I'll get a lot of sort of observations throughout the year. You know, they're really, you know, quite helpful in terms of, you know, just, you know, general sort of people, you know, seeing, you know, this changing, that changing, you know, it's quite helpful. You know, a lot of people over here, you know, the rivers, you know, it's a big part of their life too. So it's, you know, they're quite invested in it, you know, really aren't afraid to tell us about what they're seeing out there.
What's the next step for your research, Sean?
Yeah, I think it's sort of these applied areas too. You know, we've kind of spent, you know, the last several years kind of, you know, kind of looking at some of these areas, you know, where we know we can apply the science to improve conditions. So, you know, really the next steps are, you know, are really just kind of moving, you know, that science, you know, into action, you know, through these restoration projects. You know, there's sort of a number of them that we looked at, you know, pretty early in this process that are, you know, now in the queue for projects too, which is, you know, encouraging. But, you know, at the same time, you know, where there's any number that are sort of declining as we speak too. So it's, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort to improve conditions.
And just briefly, are you hearing similar stories from colleagues in watersheds in other states in the upper Mississippi?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something we talk about, you know, at sort of, you know, regional conferences on the river too. You know, it's definitely a trend we're seeing up and down the river too. You know, this increasing, you know, volume of water we're seeing is, you know, causing a whole array of stressors on the river too. So it's, I mean, it's generally sort of, you know, kind of five states sort of speaking in unison in terms of what we're seeing.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That's Sean Giblin, water quality specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. We talked to him today about research he's worked on looking at the effects of climate change on unique Mississippi River backwaters ecosystems near La Crosse. Coming up, a look at a big curling championship here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As I mentioned earlier, there was a big curling championship, the National Curling Club Championship, over the weekend in Wausau. With us, we have Akim Susans, president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Forrest, member of its board of directors. Let's dive in. Kim, can you tell us about the field of competitors and from how far they came to compete?
Absolutely. We had competitors from as far away as Alaska and Los Angeles, all the way over to Massachusetts. It was a great field of competitors and exciting curling.
And Jim, I understand Wisconsin teams didn't come out on top. How far did our local teams come in the competition?
Well, they were very competitive, and I know we saw emails from them this morning. They were really proud to represent the host club. They didn't do that well. They took some of the teams into extra ends, which is like extra innings in baseball. And the women's team actually beat one of the top teams. But the winners came from Colorado and New York State.
And Kim, can you talk about why curling has such a strong connection with Central Wisconsin?
There's a long history of curling. We've been curling. We started on the Wisconsin River in 1922, I think, moved to a curling facility in Marathon Park. And 10 years ago, we opened a fabulous 8-sheet building right in downtown Wausau.
And Jim, can you talk about the Wisconsin curling scene? How active is it? How much goes on through the curling season here in the state?
Well, I think you could safely say that Wisconsin, the Minnesotans might disagree a little bit, but really Wisconsin is the center of curling in the United States. I think we have more curling clubs in Wisconsin than some of the other total regions around the country. And Wausau is right in the center of the state, so we're perfectly located to host an event like this. Curling goes back a long way. As Kim said, our club goes back to the early 1900s when folks were throwing rocks out on the river. I know the Milwaukee Club goes back into the late 1800s, and some of the other clubs around the state are as old as that as well. One of the fascinating things to me as an import from Michigan is that you'll find curling clubs in some of the smallest communities in the state of Wisconsin. I was in one in Arlington a couple of years ago, and I think they have two or maybe three sheets. And it's just a very, very small club, but they're active. They have a strong membership, as we do here. We have a membership of over 400 people. And as Kim mentioned, we have curling families that go back generations. Their grandfathers and great-grandfathers, perhaps, were involved in curling, and some of those family members are still active today.
And Kim, with that in mind, what was the turnout like at this weekend's championships?
We were not sure what to expect. We had great publicity, and a lot of local people came out. There were a lot of families that came to visit their children who were curlers, and it was a very great turnout. We were very, very, very pleased with the people that turned out to watch curling. We had a lot of folks that walked in and said they had never seen a curling match, and this curling was extremely high level and very exciting to watch.
And Jim, just in our last few moments, if someone listening wants to get into the sport, doesn't know how, what would be a good starting point?
Well, our season is wrapping up, but if anyone is interested, they can go to our website, wasacurling.org, and they can click on Learn to Curl, and they can see how the curling game is played and see how they might position themselves as being someone interested in coming out next fall. We'll begin in October, and we'll have Learn to Curl sessions here at the Wasa Club several times. Those are easy to come to. You just need to wear a pair of clean rubber-soled shoes. We'll supply the equipment. We'll supply the instruction. And we like to say in a couple of hours you can learn how to curl.
Well, thanks to both our guests, Kim Soussens, president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Force, member of its board of directors. They joined us with a recap of the National Curling Club Championships held over the weekend in Wausau. Coming up Monday here on Central, or tomorrow, excuse me, here on Central Time. It is Monday. A new book traces the rise of free market anti-government thinking in the U.S. and the big businesses that promoted it. Meet the author of the book, The Big Myth, that and more tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an author shares stories of people dealing with the diagnosis of mental illness and how they shape their identities in moments of crisis in the new book, Strangers to Ourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.